I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. And Macintosh, Google, what do they have in common with AT&T or Hollywood or even the radio? A new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, Tim Wu, a professor at Columbia University, puts all of these information systems and carriers and builders of empire together and tells a coherent story of the last 100 years in which we look to the future and ask questions about, have we escaped the cycle? And there's a particular definition to that. Or are we going to watch it play out once again in the so-called information highway of the internet? Tim, congratulations for your overwhelming work. You write very persuasively, and I have to pull back whenever you write about Steve Jobs. I get to like him again. But I want to start with the empire builders of 100 years ago. Who was Thomas Newton Vail, and what is the master switch for him?
Theodore Vail is a pivotal figure in the history of the American telephone. He is the man who turned the telephone industry from a scattered, entrepreneurial, chaotic industry into a unified empire that lasted for 70 years. He's almost like a Roman Empire in American history. 110 years ago, anyone could have built a phone system. Everyone started phone companies, but he put them all together in one.
And that one eventually became AT&T, but there was an understanding when telephone first burst out of the invention of Edison and Mr. Bell and all the others in the 19th century, that there was lots of competition. How did Vail manage to convince Congress and everybody that he should dominate?
Well, it's incredibly fascinating because he saw the potential for monopoly, and he saw that it would be actually useful to have a single phone network serving everyone. So he made his case to the public. He said, a single phone system is better. We're the men to run it. We're good. We can be trusted. He turned to the government, and he, in fact, requested that they regulate him. He said, go ahead. That's fine. I don't mind. You can regulate us. And he turned to the public and he said, we will not put profit first, but we will always be a public servant. So that was his strategy. And the people and the government said, go ahead, here's your monopoly.
And that's what we call the common carrier. He represented himself as good for America, and America is good for AT&T.
Yeah, exactly.
And that conviction, this is 1910, did that require political smarts? Did he grease the path, or was the public in 1910 so overwhelmed by the telephone they were ready to obey one central switch?
I think he was a brilliant strategist. I think there were other companies at the time, like Standard Oil, which weren't as clever, weren't as appealing, and they were broken into small pieces. So it's exactly the same time period. He appealed somehow to America has it's a little bit like Google today. America is willing to trust a monopolist if they are willing to say, we will be good.
Right.
And we have that same thing with Google today. We will not be evil. And right. So we all trust them.
And that once upon a time, that was known as Vailism. I guess we'll call it Googleism today. What is the master switch? As you call, your book is called The Master Switch. How does the master switch fit for Vail and AT&T?
Well, it's a metaphor. It's not. There's no actual switch. Although AT&T was a switch-based company, it simply refers to the idea that often a single ruler of communication systems is more efficient, and there's the potential to be the one company that rules it all, whether it's the telephone or whether it's in radio, or whether it's in the film industry.
And of course, Tim Wu's book, The Master Switch, is all about the irony of committing yourself to one dominant power. Now to Hollywood. Adolf Zukor, he was a mogul, certainly, but he was up against something called the Film Trust, or the Trust. What was that, Tim?
Well, it's this fascinating early period in film. Thomas Edison, who most of people think of the light bulb associated with him, also invented motion pictures. But he wasn't much of a visionary. His idea was that motion pictures should be about 10 minutes long, no more. They should never have stars, and they should just sort of show you beautiful nature or people running around. So Zucker pioneered a different type of film. It was an outlaw, in fact, because Edison had all the patents. And so he fought Thomas Edison's cartel and came up with something we now call feature film. which is basically the idea that film could be maybe half an hour long or 40 minutes and have stars in it. Zucker invented the idea. He invented Hollywood, but he also invented the idea of just having stars in films.
And used men who transferred their operations from New York to Los Angeles. D.W. Griffith comes to mind because it was available at the time and it was far away from the trust and they could escape the competition and the confrontation. Was there a patent battle or was there a legal battle with regard to Zucker's invention?
You could call it a battle. It's more like they sued Zucker was a lawbreaker, an outlaw.
Right.
The Hollywood founders, all men from the Lower East Side, all Jewish, one Mormon, were scrappy characters, and they essentially just avoided. They knew there were patents that the trust owned, but they just avoided them. And as you said, they moved to California partially to get away from them, in this nice place called Hollywood, and that's why everything went there.
Yeah, everything went to Hollywood because it was very far from New York, and they could get away with it, and that becomes the master, Hollywood becomes the master switch holder of feature films, or what we understand to be movies.
Yeah, sure, and there's a long story there. Eventually, Zucker, being the former outlaw and the former rebel, becomes the sort of new master at some point of the film industry. Small company named Paramount eventually becomes this giant. And he pioneers the use of industrial methods for film. That is to say, what's called vertical integration. Owning everything, owning the theater, owning the distribution, owning all the actors, all the cameras. He owned everything in one shop, and that made possible a different kind of film.
Now, a third empire builder, and this is the master switch, and we're headed to Google, but you understand there may be a pattern here that's very helpful, and Tim's book is expansive in speculating about the future for Google and the Internet based on these models. David Sarnoff, who was he and what did he do about the master switch?
David Sarnoff is the pioneer who built the radio network. In the 1920s, radio was a very fragmented, competitive, entrepreneurial industry with hundreds, if not thousands, of radio stations with no single owner. They would just anyone could start. It was like a web page in the 90s. University would have one, a local club, motorcycle shops would have radio stations. It was just kind of anyone's business. And he had the idea, AT&T's idea, but he borrowed the idea of putting them all together in a chain. There was a company called National Broadcasting Systems that put it all together, and eventually they renamed it National Broadcasting Corporation, or NBC, and that was his product.
And radio is just the progenitor of television. In other words, if you go to the 1940s, companies such as Emerson and CBS, they will introduce themselves as the television and radio network empire, even though nobody owned television. It comes out of radio. Is that right, Tim?
Well, no, actually, it's not exactly right. There's a time where there's a chance. I talk about this in my book. It's a fascinating story where there is a chance for television to launch independent of radio and, in fact, challenge radio. The first radio station in America actually is set up in 1929 in Washington, D.C., very little known fact. And they're trying to start their own industry, and television is a competitor with radio, if you can imagine this. Like, they're not the same companies. But the radio trust manages to destroy, with the help of the federal government, destroy the fledgling TV industry and take over radio, TV itself. And so it's not an act of nature that made TV the descendant of radio. It was an act of murder, essentially.
Now, before we move on to the Internet, you talk about something called the cycle, and we've given examples of Vail and Zucker and Sarnoff. What is the cycle for their individual communication empires?
The cycle refers to the idea that we see the same thing happen over and over again. Something new is invented, full of promise, dreams, and hopes that it's going to change everything, radio, film. It's idealistic, leads to a very idealistic, open period where entrepreneurs start hundreds of companies. And then as the cycle turns, inevitably some strongman, Sarnoff, some of these other figures, unify the industry into a single company or one or two or three companies, and that becomes the form. So that's the cycle. It's from open to closed industries.
I'm speaking with Tim Wu. The book is The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. This 100 years, film, radio, and telephone. Now we'll turn to the beginning of the breakup and identify what happens to AT&T. that brings us today to the internet and the possibilities of the internet repeating the cycle. I'm John Batchelor, coming to you from 77 WABC in the Small Business Authority studios. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm speaking with Tim Wu, the author of the new and extremely visionary, The Master Switch, because Tim takes history, the history of AT&T, of telephony, the history of radio, and the history of Hollywood, and asks what is the pattern there that we may be seeing right now in front of us with regard the AT&T, the people who own the pipes, the broadband, Google that owns the platform, and a company like Apple that owns such a desirable product to manage both the pipes and the platform. Tim, what happens with AT&T? Whose genius is it to break it up, to countervailism?
Surprisingly enough, that belongs to Richard Nixon, or at least his staff. Nixon's White House got the idea that AT&T had just been in power for too long and were too big. I don't know why exactly Nixon and his staff wanted to break up AT&T. Maybe something. I have no idea what it was. Maybe a bad experience as a child or something. I tried to figure it out, but it is in the Nixon administration that they decide they needed to change things.
And they break it up into, well, what you'd have to say are the FCC. The way they do it is that they sort of endorse challenges without AT&T being able to crush them. They endorse challenges with equipment makers. So all of a sudden we have new inventions that don't have anything to do with AT&T. They endorse new carriers and new forms of carriers. Is it witting, or does the FCC stumble through this with suggestions from lawyers?
The FCC in this period is unusually visionary, at least in my opinion. They say, well, we need more competition. And, I mean, it's not hard to see that allowing someone else to build a telephone is going to change the market. What happens to AT&T is they're so outraged by the prospect of competition that, almost like a bull running at a flag, they go berserk and they start trying to destroy all the companies who have been licensed by the government to compete with them. And they go so far in their attacks that eventually they attract the antitrust law, and then that leads to the big breakup in 1984.
And that breakup now becomes part of the story of the internet. Tim tells a compelling story about something that you children might not know about. It's called AOL. Once upon a time, there was a guy named Steve Case. What was AOL when it was first invented, Tim?
AOL, when it was first invented, was just a thing where you dialed up with your phone, your modem, which was something made possible by the AT&T breakup. You used your modem, and you dialed up, and there was kind of a very primitive version of the internet. So it wasn't even interconnected. You just saw other AOL people on it.
But it wasn't anything that was plastic or useful, but it was a transition moment. And, Tim, you identify the crack-up of AOL when it met Time Warner, because the original vision of men who controlled content was that they were going to dominate this new beast, the internet.
Right.
How did they see the 21st century in their vision?
So in the late 90s, Time Warner, which was the largest media company in the world, said, well, there's this new thing called the internet, and we need to own it. So what do we do? And they looked around, and they said, well, look, AOL has 25 million users. If we own AOL, we'll own the internet. That turned out to be wrong. The fact is that once they owned it, they had AOL's 25 users, they had 25 million people who had an internet connection.
Right.
And those 25 million people started going to Google, and that was it.
Right. They could go anywhere. Once Google came along, and Tim has this wonderful little factoid that at one point, after Google was first invented, it was taking half of the bandwidth of Stanford University, because its address still had Stanford in it, stanford.edu. Google was that popular so quickly. People voted with their feet. Now, the story gets complicated, but Tim has a wonderful solution to it, because what we have here is the urge, the cycle, for the bigness to gobble up everything and dominate it. And the question today, is that happening again? Are we watching it? Remember, we break up AT&T into, or we break up, the cycle breaks up into the carrier, the pipes, the content, and the devices. Now we have to mention the devices. The devices I am loyal to is Apple, Steve Jobs. I'm very loyal to it. But he did not have the vision properly because he wants to control it. That's why Microsoft became a much bigger company for a while, Tim, for a while, not today. And why? What is it that Jobs was doing that was fighting the idea of openness?
Well, Jobs, Steve Jobs is a fascinating figure. He's very similar to some of the men we mentioned earlier, Theodore Vail and David Sarnoff and Adolf Zukor, in the sense that he is by nature an integrator and an empire builder.
Right.
He, like the early Hollywood moguls, thinks that everything would be better if he could take control of every aspect of it and deliver you with a finished product. And the product's pretty good. You have to give him his credit. I like them too. I have an iPad and
Watching a cowboy movie from the 50s on an iPad with Technicolor, spectacular.
Yeah, that's right. It's actually the union. I mean, he is a Hollywood guy. People don't understand this, is that his instincts are Hollywood, because he's a technology guy, but it's a Southern California kind of approach to things. And so I forgot where we were, but the future, there are obvious signs in our times of patterns repeating themselves. That is to say, two or three major firms and their allies interested in reconsolidating the industry, bringing it to heel. And the question is whether things are different this time around or whether history will repeat itself.
Well, we know that Comcast is trying to gobble up NBC right now. We know that there has been a recent fight between Cablevision and Fox, and people were deprived of sports contests. And that is part of the cycle that Tim profiles. You have a radical idea, and I like it a lot, Tim, so I just want a moment for it, the separations principle, which would be enacted by Congress. What is it, Tim?
The idea of the separations principle is to keep a distance between the people that move content and the people that create it. So in other words, one thing I've noticed from studying the history is that the greatest problems we see in American history with companies in this industry is when the people who move things around have too close a relationship or own the people who create content. So we see people trying to throw elections. You see problems with private censorship. There's a natural conflict of interest when you're the pipe and you're also the content maker. And so I proposed in the book, and it's not necessarily, it doesn't need to be a law in Congress, I should say. I think it has to start actually as a norm. People have to start thinking this would be a good idea. But to keep a separation between those two kingdoms, essentially, a little bit like church and state.
Right, like an anti-monopoly law, the one that says that if you're content, you can't own the pipes. And if you're content and pipes, you can't own the carriers, because iPad is an example of Steve Jobs owning all three. I can't get Flash on my iPad because he's forbid it. And so it's ruled
out. He hasn't gone too far. Now, if Apple started buying film studios and bought Comcast or something, then we'd be talking a different ballgame.
Well,
I'm not saying right now that Steve Jobs has gone that far, but imagine a future where Comcast, NBC, Apple, and Paramount get together to make this thing where you're with them or you're against them, and the rest of the world can go somewhere else. That's the kind of thing that the separations principle is designed to guard against. Massive vertical integration.
And that is the cycle. That would be what we've watched again and again, and they would maintain, in order to do this, that it's good for us, that they're interested in the civic good, and that it's good that everybody has an Apple branded on their communications devices and their movies, because then we're all in this together, one happy family. Isn't that the way you sell it, Tim?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Americans are suckers for convenience and basically Hollywood content, and that is exactly how it's sold. Listen, let us take care of everything. The Internet is crazy and chaotic and, it's idealistic, but there's too much going on. Let us take care of everything in one united empire. It sounds a little scary, but it also has an appeal to people. So that's why I'm concerned about it in a sense, because I think, we're a country that was a democracy, but occasionally we have somewhat instincts towards monarchy a little bit. We have a certain taste for letting large concerns take care of everything.
Right. We have a weakness for the master switch. The Rise and Fall of Information Empires by Tim Wu. I heartily recommend it before it happens. I'm John Batchelor.